I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guests are Lisa Fugard and Donna Hilbert. First up is Lisa Fugard. She was born in South Africa, is the daughter of acclaimed playwright Atoll Fugard. She came to the U.S. in 1980 to pursue an acting career and lives in the desert of Southern California. And she has written for the New York Times. Skinner's Drift, which we are going to be discussing tonight, is her first novel. Hi, Lisa. Hello. And I can't hear Lisa, and I don't know why. Stay with us, and I'll figure out what's going on here. Maybe I lost her along the way, so don't go anywhere. Listening to Writers on Writing, and I lost Lisa. We're having some technical problems. So stay with us. I'm going to play another song, and hopefully we'll have her after this song.
Now you can tell me what you want. You can howl, you can run. You can leave me here today, honey. I'm gonna love you anyway. Take it. Now don't worry about a doggone thing. It don't mean that much to me. All I know, I love you so, and that's the way it's gonna be. Thank you.
sweet thing, honey, always make my heart glad. Stepping on my toes when we dance, and even necessary bad. As long as you the one, honey, coming home.
And we have Lisa with us. Hi, Lisa. And I can't hear Lisa. Something is going on here. So stay with us.
Ow! Not gonna worry about a doggone thing. It don't mean that much to me. All I know, I love you so. And that's the way it's gonna be. It don't matter what you do. I don't care what you say.
Lisa? I can't hear Lisa.
Oh, wait.
Are you there? Are you there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There you are. We gotcha.
Yeah, you don't want to call me back on the home phone?
No, well, let's just
clearer.
Do it now because we only have a few minutes.
Oh, okay.
In any case, I gave you an intro. We were just having some technical problems here with the board.
Okay.
Okay, take a deep breath.
I'm happy to be here talking to you.
I'm happy that you're here. Skinner's Drift, your first novel. Tell me, because it's obviously this is not your life, although it's based in South Africa. Had you thought at all to? Was there any question ever whether to do a memoir or a novel?
You know, I love the veil of fiction. I feel that I can really speak the truth when I'm working with fictional characters. And the few times that I've tried to write personal essays, they've been hard for me. It's been a struggle. So I'm definitely a writer who likes that distance and sort of, you know, the freedom that I feel fiction gives me.
Mm. Talk about this book and the genesis of Skinner's Drift.
Well, it's interesting because about a year before I started writing on the book, I'd actually been hired by Outside Magazine to do this big piece on South Africa in nonfiction. And I traveled around extensively and came back and started writing, and I worked and worked and worked on this, and it was just going nowhere. And finally, I called the editor up and I said, please kill it. And he did. And about 3-4 days later, I started writing on the novel. So in hindsight, I realized that if I hadn't spent the time working on that nonfiction piece and really thinking about my country and struggling for ways to express how I felt about it, I might not have actually ended up in the territory of the novel.
Mm-hmm. So where did the character of Eva come from?
Well, here's what happened. When I was researching that article, I actually read a piece in the South African newspaper about poaching in the Limpopo Valley, and white farmers were just going crazy, shooting everything that moved. And the article made mention of a man who shot something like 20 hyenas in the riverbed. And he intrigued me, this man, and pretty soon he'd become a sort of a character for me. And then it was very soon afterwards that I thought, okay, he has a daughter. You know, what's their relationship? So that was, Martin came first, then Eva. That was pretty much how it happened.
Interesting. And then did you do a ton of outlining or plotting or backstory?
Oh, I wish I had. It might have taken me less time. I might have finished it a year or two earlier.
How long did
it
take?
I never do any outlining. I never do any plotting. And I just dived in, and basically I I wrote where the heat was. I mean, where there was something that was exciting me, that was what I wrote about. And finally, I had to sit down with all these pieces and see, you know, was there a novel? And there was. But I'm envious of writers who, you know, plot things out. I'm trying to do that right now with my next book, but I don't know how successful I'll be.
So does plot, because I know there are writers who have to outline. Mostly those seem to be mystery or suspense writers who need, you know, certain things to happen in certain chapters, and others who tend to be more literary writers who don't do that because of, I don't know, the lack of discovery along the way, that there's more of a surprise without the outline.
Oh, you're so right about that. I mean, countless times I would be at my desk and suddenly I would just, you know, be writing something and I'd go, my gosh, where does that come? Where's this going? And it always led someplace so interesting and so fascinating. And I love that. I love that spirit of exploration. So I think a plot in an outline would really hinder that for me.
Mm. Will you read to us?
Yes, absolutely.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. We have Lisa Fugard with us, author of Skinner's Drift.
I'm going to read from the opening of the book, and it's September 1997.
Okay.
Eva pressed her forehead to the window and watched the ruffle of waves rimming the coastline recede from view as the plane nosed its way toward Johannesburg. The dirt roads were visible, clawed into a land pitted and scarred by drought. She knew the hell of driving them, how dusty and worn she'd feel after jolting along one. Nothing to look at for hour upon hour but rocks and thorn trees. Maybe, if she was lucky, a jackal, a snake. Africa lay stretched beneath her like the ravaged hide of some ancient beast, and something fierce shuddered inside her, a love that startled her and set off another round of tears. The girls sitting behind her were talking to one another. 16 hours into the flight, and she still couldn't identify the language. Definitely not Xhosa. She hadn't heard any of the characteristic clicks. And not Sotho, because she would have surely recognized the rhythms, if not any of the words. At least they weren't singing. It was September, the plane only half full. Unlike the other passengers, who had shifted around after takeoff to secure banks of seats for themselves, the three girls had stayed together. They wore dark blue pinafores and light blue shirts. They looked too old to be schoolgirls, but then Eva thought of overcrowded classrooms in the townships where 20-year-old pupils shared textbooks and wrote their matric exams sitting on cement floors. They sang for the first time just before the dinner service, and their voices, full of sunshine and honey and dust, had disturbed in Eva some sodden longing for what used to be home. She wiped her eyes with the blue South African Airways blanket. She was crying for her father, because of her father. She shook her head in mild disgust at herself. Her mother was dead, worthy of her grief, and yet here she was weeping for that miserable ghost clinging to life in a hospital in Louis Trichardt. She drank two small bottles of red wine with dinner and swallowed half a sleeping pill. The soft voices behind her were murmuring something as she drifted off. In her sozzled state, she imagined it to be a lullaby, the private twittering of doves in a thicket. I think I'll stop there. How's that?
Very nice. Very nice.
Thank you.
Was that always the beginning?
Yeah, it was always the beginning. Way back when, I'd actually written the Eva chapters in first person, and it was a huge shift to try to get it back into third. But it was very important to do that.
Why is that?
Because I felt like it was important to do because there was sort of a distance that I could have in third person that I didn't have in first person.
Mm-hmm.
And also just, you know, doing that it felt epic. I mean, I naively thought, you know, well, I could just, you know, try to drag some of my old sentences into this new third person, you know, chapter, but there's no way you couldn't. I mean, it's like shooting a whole, you know, a scene from a totally different angle.
Mm-hmm.
Everything changed. And every time I tried to drag something in, it wouldn't work. But I was very glad that I made that change.
How much had you written of the book in first person?
Just the Eva chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the very first chapter I wrote is actually the third chapter in the book, Lefu's chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And his voice was actually the first one that I heard which was a bit startling to me, because I did have that moment of thinking, oh my goodness, can I write, you know, from the point of view of a, you know, an elderly African man? And I soon decided that yes, I could. That's what writers do.
Well, it's true, because I think writers are constantly questioning writing about characters that are different from them. You know, if you're a female writing about a male, is that even allowed? Although I don't know that men have the same problems, you know?
I don't think they do. But I think in a way, in this day and age, there almost seems to be more sensitivity about it, you know, particularly around issues of race and different experience. I just think as a writer, you know, you've got to go where you're called to.
Yes.
I mean, that's why we do it.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Lisa Fugard, author of Skinner's Drift, published by Scribner.
Yes.
Beautiful cover. I always mention the cover. What a beautiful cover you have. Had you seen it before? Had they sent it to you and said, what do you think?
They did. We played around with it a little bit. There were a couple of things that I, you know, we moved the images around, the rose, the thorn branch and the leopard skin, and we kind of had to play around with that a bit. But I like it a lot, yeah.
Now, earlier you said, had you plotted, perhaps it would not have taken you as long. How long did it take you? How long did this novel take?
I started writing it, the first chapter, I entered it in my computer about 2 days after Christmas in 1995. And I finally sold it about 7 days after November 5th, 2003. And that was the day my son was born. So 7 days after his birth, I got up to check my email at 4 a.m. and nursed him. And there was this great email from my my agent in London saying, guess what? Somebody wants the book. It was a wonderful moment.
That was a wonderful moment. Oh,
yeah.
That's great. Curious about growing up with a literary parent. How is that? Most writers don't have the good luck to do such a thing. You know, we come from an assortment of backgrounds, but it always I'm always just find that sort of situation envious, and imagine it gives you sort of a leg up.
Well, you know, I just love that you say the good luck, and most people always say to me, you know, oh, didn't it, you know, was it hard, was it this, was it that? And I didn't really experience it that way. I felt just language was just such a feature in our house. There were books everywhere. My parents were always talking about, you know, gorgeous, rich, interesting things. My dad was a phenomenal storyteller, and even today, like, you know, my mother's also a writer, and though I'm an only child, I have, you know, great relationships with them, but they are sometimes complicated, you know, as all parent-child relationships. But when we just sit as writers, it's just such, there's such a wonderful quality of respect and appreciation and admiration and just sort of, you know, excitement about the fact that we three write. It's really lovely. I feel very, very lucky to have that.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's great. but getting back to your book, talk about writing dialogue, because you seem to have a facility for it, and I wonder if it's always been that way, and if you just talk about it, just how you write good dialogue.
It's interesting because, you know, the first short story I ever wrote, there was one word of dialogue in it. And I never was that comfortable at first with writing dialogue, but I wish I could say something intelligent about this, Barbara, but I just it just kind of came to me. Maybe because, I don't know, because it was South Africa, because I was deeply, deeply familiar with the characters. I think, you know, the more intimate I feel with the characters, the easier the dialogue comes. I'm also interested in the things that aren't said as opposed to what's said. It's funny, but it's not something that I really consider one of my strengths to be. So I've never really given it much thought, I got to tell you.
What do you consider your strengths? Because I think, you know, as writers, I want to say, is it setting? Because your setting is very strong. And as writers, sometimes new writers, you know, they don't know if they should kind of play to their strengths or work on what they don't do so well or what they should do.
Well, I do think that one of my strengths is writing about place. And because I knew that to be one of my strengths, I was always careful not to have that be like a fallback position.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that I could write very easily and very eloquently, I hope, about landscape. And so I had to just watch that I didn't do too much of that, you know, that I had to actually then really work on, you know, on developing character, on dialogue. Maybe the dialogue is working so well because I probably gave that more attention in a way than I did, you know, things like landscape.
Sure. Hmm. Well, we are at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
I think that it's what I said about, you know, what I do when I sit down to write, which is really to write where the heat is. I mean, the thing that I, you know, write what scares you, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can remember sitting at my desk and just thinking, I cannot write this. I cannot write this scene. And those are some of the things that I'm most proud of.
Hmm.
So, you know, when I get a little nervous, a little anxious, saying, oh, my God, I can't write this, that's where I go.
Yeah, good
yeah.
advice.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
For coming, and sorry about those problems at the beginning. And
not a problem.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Lisa Fugard, author of Skinner's Drift, published by Scribner. Check it out. What a wonderful book, startlingly wonderful cover, and an eloquent writer. So check out the book. Stay tuned. When we return, poet Donna Hilbert will be with us, and that should be in just a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We were here with Lisa Fugard from 5 o'clock after we got some technical difficulties solved. But we're back, and Donna Hilbert is on the line, and let me just say a few words about her. First of all, we haven't had a poet on in quite a while, and Donna is a wonderful poet. Her latest poetry collection is Traveler in Paradise, New and Selected Poems, Pearl Editions, 2004. Earlier books include Transforming Matter, Deep Red and Women Who Make Money and the Men Who Love Them, which is actually short stories, winner of England's Staple First Edition Biennial Prize. Her poetry is all over the place. Her biography is included in the Greenwood Encyclopedia of American Poetry. She lives in Long Beach, California. Her website's donnahilbert.com. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Barbara.
And, you know, it occurs to me with you coming on and it being April that it's National Poetry Month. And I wonder if, being a poet, if you at all acknowledge National Poetry Month, or if it's how you feel about it. I've heard poets say different things.
Well, every month is Poetry Month for me.
Yes.
But there's a little bit more action, I guess, in April.
Mm-hmm.
I did a symposium last week at UCI.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I'm teaching the Penn Master Class for their Emerging Voices program, and that happens to be in April. I don't know if they really planned it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's just wonderful, you know, that I think everyone's awareness of poetry is a little bit elevated in the month of April.
Yeah.
But
Do you think poet laureates have much of an effect on poetry in this country anyway?
Well, I think some of them certainly have. Robert Pinsky was very, very active. And I think brought the awareness of poetry to a pretty wide audience. And then Billy Collins,
mm-hmm.
his poetry is, I think, so accessible. And
he's one of the more accessible poets, too, which is interesting, especially when he was poet laureate. He came on the show a couple of times.
Well, and, he's a wonderful, entertaining man.
Yes.
And I was a fan of his when nobody knew his name.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about your work. Because you also, I see you also write short stories. I'm curious if you were always a poet, if you were from a young age, or how it came about.
Well, you know, I've loved poetry all my life. I think when I was a little girl, my mother sent me to elocution class, of all things, probably something just, you know, little small-town rural girls would ever be exposed to. But I was just fascinated by, you know, language. They would teach us little Peter Piper picked a pack of pickled pepper type things.
Mm-hmm.
And I just loved it. And there was always a little bit of poetry in my house. And, I read everything I could get my hands on. I think I was just, you know, seduced by the musicality.
Mm.
You know, and then in high school, I was in love with Edgar Allan Poe and, you know, anything I could get my hands on. But actually, when I started writing seriously, I started writing fiction. And my teacher said that if I took a poetry class, he thought it would help my fiction.
Interesting.
And then when I did that, it was just, you know, falling in love
mm-hmm.
in a serious way with poetry.
Now, say a little bit more about that, because I, too, think that no matter what you're writing, actually, you should be reading poetry. Even if you never have any desire to write it, you should be reading it.
Well, it is, I think, the most distilled form of communication. Every word in a poem has to be the right word. It's such a compact, short form. Certainly the most musical form of writing, imagistic. Anything that is, you know, good in a good poem, I think, is instructive for prose. And I'm not certain it works the other way around.
Yeah, I don't think it does.
But,
do you think poets should study formal poetry or study poetry in a formal way, you know, the classics and as far back as they can go?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that poets should read poetry, you know, dating back, you know, all the classics. Absolutely. The poem itself is the best teacher. I think that's the way to really educate a poet, is to read poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly much can be learned from reading formal poetry, even if you don't employ traditional form in your own work. You will still see how a poem goes together. And it might, you know, force you. I always make my students write a sonnet or, you know, do some experimenting in form. And I think that it takes them places they wouldn't ordinarily go. Doesn't mean the poem's going to end up in a form. I know I've run a lot of things through the Villanelle just to maybe learn what music might be available to the poem, but, you know, it seldom ends up that way.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Donna Hilbert, author of Traveler in Paradise, New and Selected Poems, and Transforming Matter. Will you read to us?
I'm sorry?
Will you read to us?
Certainly.
All right. Whatever you like.
Whatever I like. All righty. Well, I think that I will start with a poem which dates back to kind of my earliest days writing poetry, and in the mid-80s, I guess. And poets are often asked, you know, what is the subject of poetry? And oftentimes I hear the answer that I would probably give as well. It's either, you know, love, death, and gratitude, I think, are the big subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're quite intertwined. So I'm going to read a poem called In Plowboy's Produce Market.
Okay.
I push my cart through Plowboy's Produce Market, gleaning this song for the first days of fall. Broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kohlrabi. The price of red pepper is dropping. Eggplant shines purple. Bell pepper is green. I watch an old couple choose string beans. She fills their sack by handfuls. He frowns, empties the bag back into the bin, then turns each bean to the light before dropping it in. Patty pan, crook neck, pumpkin, zucchini. A woman wearing a scarf tight at her chin eats Thompson's seedless from the grape bin. Tokay, exotic, muscat, red flame. At the melons, a man in white shorts, skin brown as russet potatoes, swings a cantaloupe into his cart. I think I'm in love. Wine, sap, pippin, golden, delicious. Where last week there were plums. Old man, kiss your wife. Wash your face in the juice of ripe fruit. Put beans into your sack without looking. Old man, we're in Plowboys. Every bean is perfect. Every bean is right.
Thank you. Now tell me, how did this poem begin? Did it begin with an image? Did it begin with being in a market?
It did. It began with being in a market. I think this often poets approach poetry from a couple of angles, and I tend to approach it from something that actually happens to me, you know, from something I see or hear that will start a poem, and then if it, you know, ends up meaning something beyond that, I'm happy about it. But this actually did start in Plowboy's Produce Market, which was an absolutely wonderful market in Hawaiian Gardens, which has been replaced with a casino.
Of course.
I mourned that. But I actually saw this couple, you know, fighting over the string beans. You know, and I just thought, you know, everything here is perfect. I don't need to fight about it. So actually everything in the poem I witnessed, and you know, actually it's a little bit about my, you know, I think that it says something about at least how I see life. You know, right here, right now.
Yes. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Donna Hilbert, poet, author of Traveler in Paradise, New and Selected Poems. Read another.
Okay.
And we have about 10 more minutes tonight. We, again, are going to be preempted by a baseball game this time. Imagine. So, we have 10 more minutes, though. So, anyway, here's Donna.
Gravity. What binds me to this earth are the hands of my children as I hold my mother, holding her mother back to the mother who begat us all. This is gravity. This is why we call the earth mother. Why all rising is a miracle.
Now talk about this one.
Well, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly when I, what period of my life I wrote this. I mean, I'm very involved with my children, and you know, again, I guess a little bit of a philosophical statement in the end that you know, it's the family ties that really, you know, keep us tethered to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know that I can really say anything more about this poem.
Sure.
It is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the trouble with talking about poetry. If you can talk about it in prose, you know, then you've got it figured out and you write an essay. And for me, you know, the poem itself usually says pretty much what I have to say on the subject, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to explain it any other way.
Sure. Now, how do you teach poetry? Because it seems to be rather difficult to critique poetry, unless, well, I suppose if everybody is a poet in a workshop and very serious about it, it becomes easier than if you're a poet in a workshop of, say, fiction writers. But how do you teach poetry, especially free verse, especially poetry where you're not writing to a structure?
Well, I don't know if you so much teach it as allow it to happen in your presence. I've been teaching a workshop for about, well, since 1989, however long that is. And we have, I think, a very loving group where everyone feels very safe to experiment and to really reveal things about themselves. And we sort of have a rule that nothing is said unless what is said will bring the work forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, having loving listeners perhaps is the most instructive thing, and reading poetry itself. I'm really, really pushing my students right now to make their own personal anthologies of favorite poems. And by reading a great deal, you know, you can learn what works and what, you know, speaks to you and what might speak to someone else. So the poem is the best teacher.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you said about, you know, you don't know if it's teaching so much as allowing it to happen. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I think, you know, for any communication to take place, there has to be, you know, the sender and the receiver, and I think, you know, new poets need to be heard and need to have some sort of venue where they can read their work and know that somebody is listening and listening keenly and with good intentions.
Mm.
I think the relationship that we develop in the workshop is as important as anything that goes on. And then it's just, you know, if you have a sense of freedom that, you know, you're willing to try and fail and willing to say what's on your mind, you know, then some good poems happen. I'm very proud of my students. I think they're quite brilliant.
Mm. Yeah, it is. It's important to have good teachers as well.
Yeah.
You know, someone who can, I think, take hold of a group and direct it without being too obvious.
I try. I know the best teachers I've had were just sort of indicate where there might, you know, be something I should look at rather than saying, that just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And something else you said is so true in terms of, I suppose, writing whatever it is you want to write, but in terms of poetry, and reading good poetry and keeping that going. And, I had a student who said, you know, that they didn't read. They just, you know, they wrote, but they didn't read. And I found that very curious.
I find that the most annoying thing that anyone, I've had the same thing happen. Nobody usually will say that to me twice, though. I can't imagine why anybody would want to write if they didn't love to read. And
yeah.
I don't know why any you know, one would want to write poetry if they didn't read poetry.
Yeah.
Heaven knows there's not enough readers of poetry as it is.
Right.
We at least should be able to count on the people who write it or want to write it.
I always encourage my students to buy poetry and support the poets. And
well, thank you very much.
As well as just to help your own writing.
Yeah, we could use some supporters, that's for sure.
We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you could offer a few pearls of wisdom for the writers listening.
Well, never give up. I think that, you know, if you are compelled to write, then you just must do it. And write every day. You know, you just don't know where it's going to take you.
Yeah.
Don't be discouraged. If you're compelled to write, it probably means you have something to say. And, you know, we need all the people who are willing to tell the truth. Mm. We need that in a society.
Yeah.
And I think poets may be the last bastion of truth tellers. We really have nothing to lose.
Mm. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Barbara, for inviting me.
You're quite welcome.
It's a real pleasure.
And your website is donnahilbert.com.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
That was Donna Hilbert, author of Traveler in Paradise, New and Selected Poems, and Transforming Matter. She's in the Los Angeles area and does workshops. We're at the end of our time. Baseball's coming on. If you would like to know more about this show, go to penonfire.com. And there you can find out all sorts of things. Next Saturday is the Palm Springs Book Festival in Palm Springs. If you Google Palm Springs Book Festival, you will go to the website. I'll be there. There'll be a ton of panels going on. And it's free, and it's outside. It should be a good day. I'm going to leave you with a quote from Grace Paley, who said, "You become a writer because you need to become a writer, nothing else." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.